Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa History Camp 2021 is coming up on Saturday, February 20th. It is fully virtual this year, and this is the fifth year for Iowa History Camp. It's a gathering of history lovers, usually physical, virtual this time, from all walks of life who come together to learn about history and share their expertise. History buffs of all kinds will be presenting at the camp, and there's still time for you to register to spend the day learning. This hour, we'll have a preview of some of this year's presentations, and my first guest is Linda Griffith Smith. She is a genealogist based in Madison County, and her presentation focuses on the years that George Washington Carver, a renowned Black scientist and humanitarian, a man born into slavery, the years that he spent in Iowa. Linda, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. And tell me first, what captured your attention about the time that George Washington Carver spent in Iowa?
Well, since I'm based in Madison County, we wanted to know exactly what his time here looked like. It had often been the topic of various stories, and we wanted to get the facts down a few years ago. So that's where it started, is his time in Madison County. And then I was asked by the Iowa History Camp to expand that to include all of Iowa. So I learned some new things, too.
Well, and George Washington Carver, he was born into slavery in Missouri, and he, as he became free, he spent really his whole life pursuing education, knowledge, and learning. And before he came to Iowa, he had been homesteading in Kansas, saving up money in the hopes of going to college. And he came to Winterset, Iowa. Tell me a little bit about the time that he spent there.
Yes, I'm going to start back just before that, because he did have such a struggle to try to build up his education. And in Kansas, he finally did graduate from high school, which was equivalent to a 10th grade education for us, and he really thought he was going to get to go to college. Highland College accepted his application, but when he got there, he was kept out because of his race, and it wasn't because it was a white college, it's because it was an Indian college. And they were afraid that their contributors might not like the fact that there was a Black person there, and their donations would dry up. So he just had his hopes dashed at that time, and in fact went out to western Kansas and homesteaded for a couple years. But he eventually wanted to get back to his pursuit of education, and we don't really know why he ended up in Winterset, but he did. And here he met a couple that helped him assess his life and move him on to the other schools.
Well,
in
Iowa. Yeah, and they directed him toward Simpson College in Indianola. Why do you think Simpson College seemed like a place that might be welcoming?
Well, the couple's name was Milholland. She discovered him singing in the Baptist church, and he had a very unique voice his whole life because he had so many respiratory illnesses that his voice remained almost a soprano singing voice. And the Milhollands discovered him at the Baptist church. They invited him into their home, and Helen Milholland and George Washington Carver had many things in common, art and plants and music. So they traded lessons with each other, and art was really his passion, as from my reading. And so they decided that he could and should go to Simpson College that had an art program that he could be part of.
And then he was focused on painting, right?
He was. He had an art instructor, Etta Budd, who was another instrumental person in his life, and she took him through 2 years of art school there and even said towards the end, "If I'd known all your talents, I would have pointed you in a different direction."
George Washington Carver arrived at Simpson in 1890. He was not the first Black student at Simpson College, although he was one of very few. And Simpson College's namesake, Bishop Matthew Simpson, was a leading abolitionist. So there was that was an important part of the mission of Simpson College.
I know he was in an art class with enrollment of 20, and all the rest were young women. He was the only Black. And Simpson embraced him. He really went there with nothing, and it was his tendency. He found basically a shack to live in on the edge of campus, took in laundry, but the students there immediately took to him and would slip coins under his door, bring their laundry, slip tickets to events, and encouraged him to participate with them in every way.
So from Simpson College, he moved on to Iowa State University. And you mentioned his instructor at Simpson College. She was instrumental in making that happen.
Yes, she was. Her father was Joseph Budd, who was a botany professor at Iowa State. So she made that connection for Carver, and he went on to Iowa State to finish his bachelor's degree the last 2 years. But he was not accepted as well at Iowa State.
He was the first Black student at Iowa State University, and he was not
Definitely.
Allowed to live in the dormitories. He wasn't allowed to eat with the other students there. But he did make some really extraordinary connections with members of the faculty there.
Yes, yes, he did. There were several well-known names that he connected with there. Bud is probably the least well-known of them, but he also connected with Tama Jim Wilson, who had already been in the United States Senate, and they became fast friends. George just had the kind of personality, one, that his genius was so obvious, and he was such a nice, nice person that people were really drawn to both his intellect and his personality. So Wilson was one. Dr. Lewis Pamel was another that he became very close with, and he even began authoring papers with Dr. Pamel during his undergraduate years, which speaks to his intellect. And then he ran into the Wallaces as well. They're well known in Iowa. And Henry C. Wallace was a professor there, and Carver was very close with him and his family. And Henry A. Wallace, Henry C.'s son, was later said to, later said that Carver introduced me to the mysteries of botany and plant fertilization. And Carver would take Henry A. out into the woods and teach him about plants when he was just a child, 6 years old.
How long did he spend at Iowa State University?
He spent the 2 years of undergraduate work and then went right into 2 years for his master's.
And then he did not stay in Iowa after that. This is where, I guess, a lot of people's knowledge of George Washington Carver comes into play, because he was recruited to help Booker T. Washington turn Tuskegee University into a very special place, wasn't he?
Yes, yes, he did. As he reached the end of his graduate course, those professors that I mentioned just couldn't imagine that he'd go anywhere else. He was such good friends with them, and they were so dependent on him. And he was starting to feel that his goal in life should be that he helped his own race where they needed to be helped. And he decided that agricultural was the place that he might be able to provide his own people some freedom. So one university that heavily recruited him was Alcorn University in Mississippi. And he needed letters of recommendations, and these professors wrote those for him, but they're all very mournful that we never thought he'd leave us, and you better take good care of him. And Booker T. Washington reached out to him too, but George was pretty well set on Alcorn University until he and two of those professors went to Cedar Rapids and met Booker T. Washington, and he was quite charismatic and quite free with his promises, and after that, George decided that Tuskegee was where he needed to be.
And he had such a remarkable and long career at Tuskegee. It sort of breaks my heart that so many people who hear the name George Washington Carver think, oh, yeah, he's the guy who invented peanut butter, because I don't think he did technically invent peanut butter. And he did so much more than that. What do people need to know about George Washington Carver?
I think his life mission to help his race is very important to know. Times at Tuskegee were not easy, but he did invent many things for peanut butter, except peanut butter, and also sweet potatoes. And the whole reason for that was those farmers down there were planting what they knew, cotton, year after year after year, and they were depleting the soil. And just as here in Iowa, we plant corn and then usually rotate to soybeans because they work together, he worked on plants that were underneath the ground, legumes like peanuts and sweet potatoes, so that the farmers would start to alternate their crops, but there was nothing in it for them to grow sweet potatoes and peanuts unless there was a market for them. So when he worked so hard to create over 300 items made out of peanuts and I think about 150 out of sweet potatoes, he was just trying to help his people economically.
And he did in such an extraordinary way. And it's so interesting to think about that crop rotation recommendation that he was making at a time when we just didn't know that much about that. And of course, those same principles are put into play today on farms everywhere. And his time in Iowa was brief, but it was an incredibly important turning point in his life.
It was. He came here dejected. That's why I wanted to talk about Highland. But he left here just known across America and with a goal in mind and had finally reached that goal of an education for himself, but yet something he could pass on to others.
Linda, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And I hope people sign up for the camp. And it is free, too.
Linda Griffith-Smith is a genealogist based in Madison County. Her presentation at Iowa History Camp 2021 focuses on the years that George Washington Carver spent in Iowa, both at Simpson College and at Iowa State University. Iowa History Camp is coming up on Saturday, February 20th. It's a fully virtual event this year. You can still sign up to spend Saturday learning about all kinds of different things about Iowa history. It is free and open to the public, but you do need to register. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio, and part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Iowa History Camp 2021. It is, of course, a virtual event this year. Coming up on Saturday, February 20th, history buffs of all kinds will be presenting at the camp, and there's still time for you to register to spend the day learning. This hour, we're previewing some of this year's presentations, and with me now is Reginald Green, Emeritus Administrator at the University of Northern Iowa and the man behind the Hidden Heritage Project. It's a virtual museum at the moment. He'll be introducing campers to Iowa's forgotten black champions, the Algona Brownies. Reginald Green, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So take us way back in time. This is just at the turn of the 20th century when the Algona Brownies came into being. What happened?
Well, it was a situation where businessmen who really enjoyed baseball decided to start a club, a baseball organization there called the Algona Baseball Association, and put together a team. It was interesting that they annually play a North Side versus South Side baseball game between the two business groups, but they thought that with a well-known baseball team, they could bring notoriety to the town and enhance the business opportunities that they were providing.
It's so remarkable. 1901, this was a mixed race team. Help me understand just how unusual that was for that time.
I couldn't speak to overall how unusual it was, but people of color were playing baseball all over the country. And there were some teams, for example, like Waseca, Minnesota had some outstanding black pitchers and catchers. They were playing around that time. Just prior to that, like in 1895, well, I think it was 1894, the Page Fence Company out of Adrian, Michigan, had an all-black team that was a traveling team. They weren't affiliated, like a lot of these teams were not affiliated with any leagues, and they were able, you know, were able to put together a very strong team, and some of their players became Brownies, and they traveled around. They had their own train car, and they were advertisement for the Page Fence Company. So you could see that at a lot of different places.
So the upper levels of baseball were fully segregated at that time, but some of these smaller teams were still integrated and playing together. When you first found information about this team, though, you were surprised. You were surprised that the Algona Brownies were in Algona, Iowa.
Correct.
Tell me about that discovery.
Well, when I first, I was going through some listings and I saw it, and I was familiar with Algona because I attended college in Forest City, Iowa, and I thought, oh, how interesting, there's an Algona somewhere else in the United States, because surely
that didn't Algona, happen in our Iowa. Algona,
yes.
Right?
No. But then later on, I also found out that the white owner of the Kansas City Monarchs lived in Algona when he was a youngster. So there's a couple of connections, and he started at about the time the Algona Brownies went away, he started the All Nations team, which was a racially diverse international, I shouldn't say international. There were people of Asian descent, as well as Native Americans and African Americans, and on that team. So, it was a little bit surprising. But then when I found that out, I decided when I would have time after I retired from UNI, I would invest in time going over there and seeing what I could find out about the Brownies.
Well, and it was a fairly short-lived enterprise, a successful but short-lived enterprise. The Algona Brownies played from what, 1901 to 1903?
Correct. And there's speculation why they were no longer playing there. Because all the indications that I was able to find in newspaper accounts, that's basically where there is reliable information about them, indicated that they were planning, you know, in late 1903 and into early 1904, that they were planning to come back together. But the players shifted and went to different teams, and which was a typical kind of thing in those days that players would shift from teams to team and wherever they kind of got a good deal, even in the middle of the season, that would happen.
Yeah. In your research about the Algona Brownies, you have learned about some of the standouts from that team, mm-hmm. and one of them is George Johnson, better known as Chappy Rat, which
yes.
is just a great baseball name.
Yes.
Tell me about George Johnson.
Well, George Johnson Jr., he had a couple of nicknames, Chappy as well as Rat. He was an outstanding catcher, probably one of the top catchers of the time. And most of the great teams like Page Fence, the Cuban X Giants, the St. Paul Colored Gophers, the Columbia Giants out of Chicago, the Brooklyn Royal Giants, he was a player for them. And he came from Bel Air, Ohio, and played baseball from elementary school through high school through town teams in Ohio, and gained some notoriety as a young person. And an interesting aspect of his life, even though Major League Baseball, white organized baseball, talked about, prevented blacks from participating. He was a person who was hired to coach catchers for the Boston Red Sox hired him, and the top minor league team out of Minneapolis hired him.
So even though he couldn't play Major League Baseball, he coached in the majors.
He was good enough to coach players.
Reginald, we are out mm-hmm. of time, but thank you so much for sharing this
sure.
history. And it sounds like there's so much more to discover. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Reginald Green of the Hidden Heritage Project. His presentation is called Iowa's Forgotten Black Champions at History Day, or History Camp, coming up on Saturday. And now we're going to talk about a black champion who spent time in Iowa who has not been forgotten. The football field at Drake University is named after him, but his is still a story that is very important to tell. His name is Johnny Bright. Hope Bibbins is political papers archivist and associate professor of librarianship at Drake University. She'll be giving a presentation at Iowa History Camp called The Johnny Bright Incident. And she is with me now. Hello, Hope.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And for people who aren't familiar, tell me who Johnny Bright was.
Sure. So Johnny Bright was a black player on Drake's football team from 1948 to 1951. And so this was really the golden era of Drake football. This was a time when Drake was playing in bowl games and against teams like Iowa State and Notre Dame. He came to Drake from Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was a halfback and a quarterback on the football team. He also played basketball and ran track while he was at Drake. But in 1951, he was a candidate for the Heisman Trophy. And he would have been the first African-American to win the award, if not for the incident that took place during a game at Oklahoma A&M that year.
Well, and I just want to underscore what a remarkable athlete he was. I mean, he was just top in so many different sports.
Right. Three-sport athlete, played multiple positions on the football team, had records, at Drake and nationally.
So he was focusing a lot of his time on football, and he was a star for Drake University, but it was not typical for a team to be integrated in that time. And tell me what happened with this incident that you're talking about, because this was a terrible, terrible moment of racially motivated violence.
Right. So Drake was undefeated at the time. They looked like they were going to win the conference championship. They went on their road trip down to Stillwater, Oklahoma, to play Oklahoma A&M, which is now Oklahoma State. And during the first few minutes of the game, Johnny Bright was actually knocked unconscious, had his jaw broken by blows from an Oklahoma A&M player. And that attack essentially ended his collegiate career. And based on my research, there were accounts of rumors that the Oklahoma A&M players were going to target him during the game. And one of the interesting things about it was that it all happened away from the ball. So no one really seemed to see what happened in real time because everyone in the stadium was watching the ball carrier. But there were photographers from the Des Moines Register at the game, and they captured a sequence of six photographs of the incident. So it was really the photographs that would, you know, kind of stir up and cause this national outrage and a heightened awareness of the racism that Black athletes faced at the time.
Well, and how did people react once those photos became public?
Right. So Johnny Bright said in an interview later in his life that there was no way that that it could not have been racially motivated. And Drake University actually ended up withdrawing from the Missouri Valley Conference, which is the conference they played in for football at the time, when the conference didn't take any action against Oklahoma A&M or the player. And then after that incident, the NCAA actually changed some rules to require players to wear helmets with face masks. So before that, they were not wearing helmets with face masks. They made it illegal to hit a player with your forearm or elbow or a locked hand. So there were some rule changes that took place after this incident as well.
What happened to Johnny Bright?
So Johnny obviously did not go on to win the Heisman Trophy. He was sidelined for the last three games of the season. He ended up being drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles in the NFL. And to my knowledge, he would have been the first Black player on the Eagles. But due to the likelihood of additional racist incidents, he decided to go play in the Canadian Football League, where he became a Hall of Famer. And the other piece of the story that I really like from a student athlete perspective is that when he retired from football, he became an educator. And he eventually became the principal of a middle school in Edmonton.
Of course, the football field at Drake University was named after Johnny Bright. So students at Drake learn his name, even if they don't necessarily hear the story. What was it that captured you about this story and it made you want to tell it at History Camp?
You're right. Johnny Bright's legacy, it really does loom large at Drake. His number's retired. The football field is named after him. The university just named a new college after him. And so the story is such a good jumping off point or a window through which we can view so many different aspects of history. We can have discussions about racism, discrimination, athletics. And so I like sharing it with students because it's relatable, it's local, it's a good way to introduce them to primary sources or archival research, how they can use records that were created at the time, the student newspapers, the yearbooks, how they can use photographs in the research and then take it and go study so many other interesting aspects of the time period.
As you did this research, were you hoping to find something new to share about Johnny Bright?
That's a good question. So information on Johnny Bright is probably one of our top reference requests that we get in Drake University archives and special collections. So as an archivist for me, it's always going to be all about the documents. We have a Johnny Bright collection. And in my talk on Saturday, I'll share some items from that collection and how people can access them online. But I also wanted to see if I could uncover anything new in preparation for an exhibit that we're putting together this fall. And so I've enjoyed, you know, combing through the yearbooks, the student newspapers to see what else I can find. And so it's kind of like a treasure hunt. What can I find on this topic? And then, you know, I come across so many ideas for other topics, you know, other student athletes of color that came before Johnny and their experiences. women student athletes at Drake are just a couple of things that I've come across while working on this project.
So has that led you in directions that you'll continue pursuing?
Definitely. We're always, you know, looking to tell those stories of the history at Drake.
Well, Hope, thank you so much for sharing this story with us today. And is this the first time you've participated in Iowa History Camp?
This will be my second time presenting at History Camp. I've also presented, my main job at Drake is to work with our political papers collections. So I've presented on the Harkin Steak Fry at History Camp before. So this will be my first Drake-related topic, though.
Nice, nice. Well, and hopefully next year you'll be able to do something else, and we'll get to see everybody in person next year. But Hope Bibbins, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Hope Bibbins is political papers archivist and associate professor of librarianship at Drake University. She'll be giving a presentation at Iowa History Camp on Saturday called The Johnny Bright Incident. And you can find out more about Iowa History Camp online. I'll talk with historian Leo Landis in a moment about the presentation he'll be sharing. We'll also talk about History Camp and how this virtual camp is working this year. That's coming up in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about Iowa History Camp 2021. It is a virtual event this year coming up on Saturday. History buffs of all kinds will be presenting at the camp, and there's still time for you to register to spend some time learning on Saturday. This hour, we've been previewing some of the presentations this year, and now Leo Landis is here with us, curator of the Iowa State Historical Museum. And we will talk about his presentation about Iowa during the Civil War in just a moment. But Leo, as one of the founders of Iowa History Camp and one of the organizers for this year, putting it together as an all virtual camp must have been a little bit disappointing, but I'm glad it's been able to continue. Tell me about the plans for this year.
Sure. And we're excited. And Hope Bibbins is a little modest, too. She's one of the founders as well. So Hope Bibbins, Danny Ackright, Megan Ben Dixon, and I have been working on History Camp since 2015 for every year. And we knew that we still weren't going to be able to gather in person, and with the support of Drake University and the State Historical Society of Iowa, we're able to use Zoom accounts and so offer the programming through Zoom. And if your listeners Google History Camp Iowa, they'll find our site, and they just go to the program and can register for the Saturday presentations and check out whatever ones they want.
All right. And that is free and open to the public. And it looks like you've focused on really the morning of Saturday.
We did. Normally, we would do a full day, but we know a lot of folks have been doing virtual programming in their work life, and we just didn't feel, from our own experiences, wanted to try to pull off a full day of programming, but thought having 15 exceptional programs on Saturday morning was a good way to keep people engaged with History Camp Iowa.
Right. So a wonderful opportunity to learn, even if you have a little bit of Zoom fatigue.
It's not, exactly.
It's not going to be all day, but there are really so many great topics to choose from. And we've just been sharing some of the presentations. And of course, people will notice that of the presentations we've been sharing, there's been a real focus on Black history in Iowa. Is that an overall theme of History Camp this year?
It was a story we wanted to share, and we were just fortunate enough that we had some really good presentations. I mean, it was great to hear Reginald bring up the Algona Brownie story, and so that's what I'm looking forward to. I know a little bit about that. Some of them are going to be recorded, if not all of them, so we'll try to have those posted a little later next week. If somebody can't attend, like Reginald's presentation will be recorded, so that's something we'll be offering as well. But we like to focus on Iowa history, but as you have said and other presenters have said, we like to take anybody who just has an enthusiasm and a good ability to tell stories. And so Tammy and Kelly Rundle, who do great documentaries, are going to talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe and her experiences in Ohio and the film that they made about her. So we've got some presentations outside of Iowa as well.
Well, and this week in the lead up to History Camp, you've already started doing virtual visits to some museums around the state of Iowa, which, what a wonderful way to, I know they're all sold out, so I'm not promoting them. People were obviously very excited about this opportunity, but I'm certainly going through museum withdrawal as well, and I'm sure a lot of people are.
Yeah, Dia Nagaraj of the Museum of Danish America did a great program, and that one is recorded that we'll be sharing. She talked about some of the Danish porcelain and just the Museum of Danish America in Elkhorn, and then we aren't able to record the next two. I'm doing one, but Friday night we'll be featuring stories from our Iowa 175 exhibit coming up, Iowa People and Places. So people can come and see the exhibit because we are still open, whereas Museum of Danish America is not yet.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your presentation, Iowa and the Civil War Homefront, which is something that you and I have had an opportunity to talk about on the air in the past as well. But why did you choose this topic for this year?
It's a story that people often think of the battles, and we didn't have battles in Iowa, but I would argue that no state was really more affected by the Civil War than Iowa. We were a brand new state. We were just opening up to land purchases, especially in western Iowa, and that's something that, you know, we don't always think of. You had towns like Dubuque and Davenport and Fort Madison and Keokuk that were large towns and counties over 20,000, but western Iowa, especially northwest Iowa, was still being open up for land purchases. So Buncombe County, which was what Lyon County was known as in 1860, it didn't even have people reporting, nor did Osceola County in northwest Iowa, of being in that county in 1860. And Sioux County only had 10 people. O'Brien County had 8 people. So there's a 5-year period in our state's history where settlement just kind of stops, where people don't buy land and they don't come to our state, when we were just taking off and we've got, you know, we're an agricultural nation at the time and we've got the best farmland in the world, and yet you can't buy land in Iowa, or you could, but you weren't, because we had this national catastrophe happening.
Wow. And just the fact that Iowa was such a frontier state at that time, I think, is something that is almost hard to understand.
It was, and yet we know this from our Iowa People and Places exhibit. Like, there were European musicians coming to Davenport and performing in 1858. So you look at eastern Iowa and you have, you know, well-settled, fairly urban communities, and then western Iowa is just starting out, and it truly is, you know, land other than native peoples hasn't had any established settlements at all. So the Civil War truly does disrupt that, and we don't have much growth in our state through that 5-year period.
We did send a lot of soldiers to the war in the Civil War, and I know we're not focusing on that part of it, but that meant that a lot of families were left behind in Iowa without the head of the household, the men.
Exactly. And it was an opportunity for women really to take a leadership role. We think of, you know, World War I, of women working in factories at times, and really World War II, but on the Iowa home front, women do take the lead on so many farmsteads and have to make decisions. Sarah Kenyon, she's a woman who was living in Delaware County, originally from Rhode Island. She talks about the labor situation on their farm and writes back to family in Rhode Island saying that their hired man had left just as corn planting commenced. So she shouldered a hoe and worked out in the field, and her services are just as acceptable as his. And that's a quote actually Ken Burns uses in the Civil War film. She doesn't get the credit, but that's one of the things where women were doing the work too. And for immigrant women, that was sometimes viewed as okay. But this is where women across Iowa were doing all the jobs that, you know, the men who were serving were not able to do because they were needed in the battles.
Well, that's kind of hard to wrap my mind around, because the work of women on farms at that time was just as difficult as the work that men were doing. So now these women were taking on both jobs.
That's correct. And you think about, you know, the women were keeping the home operating by cooking and doing other production. Now they were put into service on other jobs, you know, and they really did meet the needs of the nation and the state on those fronts. There's a farmer, Joseph Miller, up in the McGregor area in northeast Iowa, who was talking about his daughter, Sarah Jane. And Iowa was a major wheat producer at the time. And in wheat production, the grain would be cut, and then it had to be tied into bundles to dry in the field in bundles called sheaves and then in shocks. And Joseph Miller said his daughter, Sarah Jane, could beat anyone binding wheat, and he was willing to take a $10 bet that nobody could beat her.
But no record of whether or not he was taken up on his wager?
Not that we know of. A really great Iowa historian, Joe Anderson, has done some good work on that. He's up in Canada, but he did some good work on Iowa women in the Civil War home front. So I'll use a lot of his material too.
Well, and I think about the kind of work that women were doing in the home. There were not a lot of things that made that work easier, although you do have information about home technology in Iowa during that time. What's interesting about what women had access to?
Again, in the eastern part of the state, you could nearly get anything from any of the eastern industrial towns of the United States. So if you wanted to buy a cast iron stove made in Ohio or New York State, you had the ability to purchase that if you were living even in Jones County. And before the war, Ephraim Fairchild, who was farming in Jones County, just getting started, and he's a man who did die in service in the Civil War. But he talks about buying a stove similar to what his father had purchased. He got it in Wyoming. A lot of folks in Iowa that don't know Iowa geography, Wyoming's a great town in Jones County. And so he was able to buy a cast iron stove in Jones County in 1857. But again, in western Iowa, you may not have had that access. Or Alice Money, a school teacher in Polk County, she was in Des Moines. She was able to purchase a sewing machine and help bring income into their family household during the war period because she was able to sew garments and things. So women were working in different tasks and as their family was able, adapting to those new technologies that were available to them.
Now, I know your presentation isn't focusing much on the soldiers that went off to war, but Iowa did have one black regiment. Tell me about that.
What is often called the 1st Colored Regiment of Iowa or the U.S. 60th Colored Troops, that was generally the black soldiers were nationalized or put under a national regiment. But they were organized out of Iowa, out of Keokuk and Muscatine. But 1,000 black men almost serving on behalf of Iowa, they can sign up beginning in 1863. Actually, Alexander Clark had petitioned Governor Kirkwood. Alexander Clark, being a prominent black man in Muscatine, had petitioned Governor Kirkwood, and Governor Kirkwood was not able to, nor did he want black men serving earlier in the war. So once the Emancipation Proclamation allows black men to serve, black men in Iowa and Illinois and Missouri and even a couple from Minnesota sign up for the 1st Colored Regiment of Iowa. They serve ably and admirably. They're at Wallace's Ferry, Arkansas. They had marched 18 miles that day. They fought for 5 hours. They were outnumbered 3-1 in helping some Union forces withdraw. And one of the Union officers said, "Never did men under such circumstances show greater pluck or daring." So those men fighting on behalf of Iowa, we'll talk a little bit about them. We've got one of their flags in the museum collection, and it's just an important story to tell because it then sets up after the war at least a new degree of equality for black men in Iowa where they get the vote and where Alexander Clark is instrumental in that and also in getting his daughter to help integrate Iowa schools.
Well, and we know that there were really great strides for equality made in the wake of the Civil War, but we also know that there was pushback, and those stories often focus on what happened in the southern states where strides were made, and then the backlash was really just horrible and led to the Jim Crow South. But in Iowa, what was that like? Were there Southern sympathizers? Were there Confederate sympathizers? Was there a pushback against the Iowa support for the Union?
It tended to be in Irish Catholic communities, and that's where you saw, even in the East, the biggest riots during the Civil War, when Irish are concerned about how much efforts Irish immigrants are being put into work. And so Dennis Mahoney, who's a Irish Catholic man in Dubuque and one of the founders of what would become the Dubuque Telegraph Herald newspaper that's still around today, he is actually anti-slavery, but he feels like the war is unconstitutional and that the South should be allowed to secede. And so he actually publishes some anti-abolitionist pieces, and in trying to tamp down the anti-union activity, he gets arrested by Secretary of War Stanton and taken to Washington, D.C. He's imprisoned for almost 3 months and without charges. And so, President Lincoln and his administration were not above, ignoring federal law to put people in prison. And they did the same thing with another George Wallace Jones had married a Catholic French woman, a woman of French ancestry, had actually been one of our first U.S. senators and then was a ambassador. And he is also imprisoned because he had gone to college with Jefferson Davis and in 1861 had been writing supportive letters to Jefferson Davis, which were intercepted. And so while he was an ambassador getting ready to come back to the United States, George Wallace Jones, who's one of our founding politicians and a former U.S. senator, gets put in jail for a number of months without real charges. And finally, the Lincoln administration, I should say, sees that, there's not a great threat and releases both Mahoney and Wallace Jones. David Conan, who you've had on the show, has done some great work on George Wallace Jones.
It also just underscores the heightened tensions during that time. And it was just a time of enormous change. Is that why it's important to look at that time on the home front and see where Iowa went in the wake of the Civil War?
I really do like to emphasize just how much it disrupted our state and how it really then changes our state from, kind of being in what we would consider a purple state, if you wanted to go that way. We had started to lean Republican before the war. Well, after the war, you can just guarantee that most Iowans, unless it was connected to a temperance issue and you were Catholic or urban or German, you were going to vote Republican. So Republicans dominate our state after the war. It's what gets called the bloody shirt, where you just say, the Democrats didn't support the war effort. And so that changes our state. It also, was a chance for women to push for equality, having shown what they could do. And as we talked about, for black equality a little bit, of course, women don't get the vote, even though it had legs after the war. Women don't get the vote in Iowa until 1920.
That was a long, long, hard-fought battle. Leo Landis, thank you so much for talking with me, and I hope History Camp goes great on Saturday.
Thank you so much, Charity.
Leo Landis is curator of the Iowa State Historical Museum. We've been talking about History Camp in Iowa. It's coming up on Saturday. It is all virtual this year, and there's still time for you to get involved. Just do a search for History Camp Iowa, and you'll find a link to register and learn all about the presentations taking place on Saturday morning. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.